Welcome to The World Below, The War in the Heavens, a podcast exploring the adventure, the intrigue, and the magic of a land that lies beneath the celestial battle between gods and demons, a clash that has gone on since time immemorial. I'm your guide, your interlocutor, and your host, Michael Pryor. Welcome, everyone, to episode 22 of The World Below, The War in the Heavens podcast, the second of season 3. This one is all about Queen Grippina of Anarquist, known as Grippina the Cruel. Hello, one and all. I'm Michael Pryor, and this episode looks at the period in Anarquistian history that begins what are called the Nightmare Years. Let's plunge in. In Anarquistian history, there have been a number of smooth handovers of the throne, with none of the strife, backstabbing and double-dealing that is pretty much the standard way of doing things throughout the nearly 2,000 years of Anarquistian history. One way to manage a smooth handover is to make sure that there's no one to oppose your taking of the throne by slaughtering all of the possible contenders. Grippina Anarquist did just that, and in doing so ushered in the period of Anarquistian history known as the Nightmare Years. Before we really dive into this period of unrelenting terror, a note about the sources. It's a pretty simple note because we don't have much from this period. Our usual primary sources from the early days of Anarquist come from people with enough time to sit down and write. And during the Nightmare Years, these people were usually living in fear of their lives and not really thinking about jotting down a few lines about the political and financial state of Anarquist. On top of that, Grippina and her descendants were fond of a bit of scroll burning and defacing of monuments, obliterating the past and making it in their own image, being part and parcel of their reign of terror. The nearest sources we have are written once the Anarquist dynasty is restored, and so they're looking back more than 100 years to the events. It's the best we have, so we'll make do. The overview. It was most likely that Grippina was born in 292, but there's some vagueness about that and about her exact birthplace. Her father was Sallust, one of the offspring of Queen Scindia II. He left Anarquist soon after reaching adulthood and spent most of his life as a military commander in various city-states and kingdoms across the continent, spending most of his time as the commander of a number of Jaloxian mercenary companies. Jalox, the large, inhospitable island to the south of the continent, had already gained a reputation for providing top-quality military forces to whoever wanted to pay for them, and Sallust became well known as a hard-headed leader of the fierce troops under his command. Now, there are mercenaries, and then there are mercenaries, but the Jaloxian companies were very, very mercenary. Pragmatically vicious, shall we say? It's possible that a young Grippina observed some of the methods that her father and his followers used, and these may have formed her notoriously ruthless outlook. Later, she gave differing accounts of her age and her place of birth, and it's believed she enjoyed the aura of mystery that this cultivated. Grippina spawned a mini-dynasty of 4 children who achieved notoriety of their own, having been raised in her image. Zalman the Vicious, Yefan the Bloody, Enna the Inhuman, and Keska, who was so malevolent she didn't need a cognomen. Grippina's children had 3 different fathers, all of them junior officers in her father's Jaloxian mercenaries. She reigned from 339 to 371 when she died at the age of most probably 78 or thereabouts. Now, that doesn't sound so bad, does it? And the bare bones are benign, lead out all the bloodiness of her accession and the actions she subsequently took to ensure that she stayed on the throne and was able to hand it to her children. But before we launch into examining Grippina's reign, how about a quick refresher regarding Anarquist immediately before Grippina swept in? The early. King Haldan I, Grippina's predecessor and cousin, had a troubled reign, not helped at all by his laziness and dilatory nature. It also wasn't helped by the clandestine campaign waged by Agrippina from a distance to displace him. A campaign of terror and supremely psychological manipulation, where in the last years of his reign he was driven to distraction by targeted assassinations of his supporters and relatives, all by a foe that was, at the time, completely unknown, thus magnifying the terror. Agrippina kept herself well away from Anarquist at the time, so she was never suspected of plotting until the last moment, when, after Haldan disappeared while out hunting, and his three adult children, Seltimer, Ephraim, and Abelard, were all said to have died on the same day at the hand of mysterious assassins, and then, the very next day, a band of yellow-clad soldiers strode into Anarquist and demanded entry for the heir to the throne, who was riding at their head. Well, the populace pretty much caved in and accepted Agrippina as their monarch. True heir? Maybe not, but as the granddaughter of Queen Alice II, she was of the royal family, and so she was the undisputed crowned head, at least for now. The way that Agrippina seized the crown, after many years of clever and ruthless machinations, was the first instance of usurpation in Anarquistian history up until that time. And naturally, the first time that Varfina's choice, the uniquely Anarquistian method of succession, where the living monarch designates the heir from among their children, well, it was the first time it wasn't followed. Such an overturning of what had become the natural order was very much held to be responsible for the events that followed, with dark mutterings and fearful shaking of heads commonplace for years in taverns in and about Anarquist. It's like they could tell they had a bad moon arising. Reign highlights. In a run-of-the-mill biography of any ruler, the first section is usually humdrum, with the ruler embarking on something usually called consolidating their rule. For Agrippina, however, consolidation had a particular meaning, and it meant wiping out any rivals, any potential rivals, and anyone who had even thought of becoming a potential rival. We must remember that Agrippina, in some ways, was a step back in the succession, so she was defying the expectations of the populace about the way succession worked in Anarquist. And that's not to mention the savagery with which she went about manoeuvring herself into the top job. King Haldan's children, having been killed, were no longer a threat to Agrippina, but their children certainly were. Between them, Seltimer, Ephraim, and Abelard had five children, and once the situation became clear, their remaining family members fled Anarquist with the children. Sadly, this didn't deter Agrippina. She sent assassins after all of them, with the result that Seltimer's three offspring were all murdered while hiding in the city-state of Orenthia. And Abelard's sole child, a daughter, was abducted from a refuge in the far northern realm of Framen, and never seen again. Ephraim and his four children disappeared while crossing the wilderness in search of a relative's holdings to the west of what in the present day is the kingdom of Inner Honf. Several scholars have suggested that Agrippina's actions here in seizing the throne indicate that she had many assassins at hand. Indeed, Sergei Chegny in The Black Company claims that she spent much of her time in exile assembling and training such a corps, an elite company whose members had fanatical loyalty towards her. Whether or not she did, it was indisputable she was more than willing to use assassination as a tool. After the coronation, and with Haldan's direct heirs disposed of, Agrippina took a week or two to study Anarquist's aristocrats and then cut a swathe through them. Loyalty was one issue, but any notable with riches or a following was immediately put in the suspicious basket by Agrippina. And one did not stay in that basket for very long. After the first round of executions, a panicked exodus from Anarquist erupted. Some tried to liquidate holdings and tried to turn their fortunes into something portable, but many found that this took time, and time was not on their side. Those who managed to flee Anarquist were most often the ones who left everything behind. The crown, naturally, confiscated titles, lands, buildings and riches of any of the nobles who were executed or who fled. You might think that Agrippina used these to reward her favourites, but unlike nearly every other monarch in Anarquistian history, Queen Grapina had no favourites, no inner circle, no cronies. Whether this was because she was suspicious of nearly everybody, or whether it was a deliberate demonstration that she was above and beyond everybody else, is unclear. It almost goes without saying that this reign of terror wasn't good for business. It's a matter of uncertainty, I suppose. It's hard to plan for the next financial year when you're not sure whether you'll keep your head in the next fortnight or not. And of course, with so many pulling out of Aniquist because of the uncertainty about balance sheets and mortality, suddenly the Aniquist treasury was in a bit of a precarious state. With the sort of luck that one would hope would happen to the virtuous, in 341 a minor heavenfall occurred in the far northwest of Aniquistian territory. Grapina quickly organised a well-armed expedition and claimed this prize, only having to fight off a small band of outlaws who found very quickly that they'd bitten off more than they could chew. The heavenfall was a small section of a belt with an attached buckle, 40 metres or so in length. Despite the protestations of the ecclesiasts from the temple who accompanied the expedition, Queen Grapina immediately had it broken up for easier transport and sale. The majority of scales were scintillating cerulean, highly prized at the time, and with the base material sought after for the magical power it had, the whole heavenfall gave a very useful and timely boost to the treasury. The Malbury assassination plot. As you can imagine, Grapina's approach to ruling didn't win her many friends. It did, however, cultivate numerous enemies, even though they learned to be extremely circumspect, since being an enemy of Queen Grapina, or even a suspected enemy of Queen Grapina, was a shortcut to a shortcut. A number of clandestine groups met in extreme secrecy, but as well as having an extremely loyal bodyguard corps and a fanatical group of ready assassins, Grapina had the third leg of the despot's tripod, that of a highly efficient retinue of spies. Most of these clandestine, disloyal groups were quickly infiltrated and liquidated thanks to the work of these undercover operatives. But in 352, a number of brave souls were able to organise themselves enough to make a real effort on the life of the tyrant. This came to be known as the Malbury assassination plot, after the main conspirator, Countess Lena Malbury. Most of what we know about the Malbury assassination plot comes from the writings by Elfia Malbury, a surviving member of the family writing in the late 5th century, some 150 years after the event. She claimed to have spoken to elderly family members and consolidated their memories into a narrative, while insisting that she remained impartial and objective. The fact that all the plotters are portrayed as noble, self-sacrificing and heroic, while Queen Grapina and her lackeys are depraved, vicious and underhanded, perhaps gives the lie to this. But as it's the only near-contemporary record we have, there's no mention of this plot in any official source, it's all we have to go on, and all later accounts of the Malbury plot are necessarily based on Elfia Malbury's family history. The Malbury family was one of the oldest in Aniquist. Lena Malbury's great-great-great-grandmother, Hemnia Malbury, was one of those hardy and brave adventurers who accompanied Eucantha Aniquist on the expedition which found and claimed the heavenfall that was the foundation of the realm. For faithful service, she was granted land near what became the stronghold, the fortified area containing the keep, the royal palace, and underneath the fabulous Hypogeum, where the body of the dead god lay. Lena Malbury was in her early 20s when her mother spoke out against Queen Grapina's taxation laws of 356, a truly draconian but relatively egalitarian set of laws that aimed to extract as much money from as many people as possible. Lena's mother approached the Queen for an audience to discuss the matter, and unusually for her friends and relations, she wanted to address the hardship that these laws would bring to the common folk of Aniquist. She never returned from that trip to the palace. And that evening, assassins struck the Malbury mansion and turned it into a bloodbath. At the time, young Lena was out with friends and survived, but very wisely soon after fled the city for the countryside. Few people wanted anything to do with her. Friends shunned her, relatives slammed the door in her face, Acquaintances looked for her, but only so they could inform on her whereabouts and claim the reward. A distant cousin, Jansa Stettin, proved to be more steadfast. Her family had an olive-growing estate to the northeast of the castle, and Jansa's, who was around the same age as Lena, persuaded her parents to take in the outcast. An incognito Lena worked for 3 years in helping to manage the olive farm, keeping books and general administration, but also using the time to sound out those who could be trusted beyond the Stettin family. Once she established a cabal of such, she and Jansa's left the country estate and slipped back into the capital. There the plotting truly began. Lena and Jansa's mostly worked with young Anaquistians, mainly as their connections lay in those directions, but also because many older, influential Anaquistians, those who might be expected to support a resistance to such a bloody dictator, well, they'd been killed in Queen Grippina's many purges. Those who remained had obviously shown a talent for not drawing attention to themselves, and were thus not likely to support rebels of any sort. The Mulberry Cabal worked mostly from the townhouse of the Craxes family. The Craxes had left the capital for their mountain villa in northeast of Anaquist, but the second son, Allo, remained behind. He already had a reputation as a hothead and a firebrand, and had narrowly escaped the notice of the Queen's spies on a number of occasions when he undertook acts of petty sabotage and vandalism as a sign of his displeasure with the regime. He was a willing recruit to the cause, even though both Lena and Jansa's admitted that he was a potential loose cannon. Various schemes were discussed over the months that the three plotters lived secretly in the city, only setting foot outside at night. Poison was a favourite for some time, but put aside when the difficulties of getting the ingredients became apparent, after Jansa's attempted to buy such from an apothecary, who was rumoured to be greedy and tight-lipped. Fortunately, before delivery, Lena accompanied Jansa's to the apothecary's shop and insisted they wait in the shadows and watch the place for some time from a nearby rooftop. Her wariness was rewarded when soldiers surrounded the shop before entering and dragging out the apothecary. In the end, Lena and Jacinta came to the conclusion that, well guarded as Grappina was by her loyal bodyguards, getting close enough to poison, stab, or otherwise dispatch the Queen was verging on the impossible. They were going to have to rely on Lena's breathtaking slinging skills that she'd developed during the time in the country. Vermin were a major problem in the olive groves, with many of the large monitor lizards addicted to feasting on olives, ripe or unripe, and thereby ruining many a harvest. These lizards moved deceptively quickly and were fierce in close quarters, so roving bands of slingers patrolled the groves to keep the numbers down. Young Lena learned from the best of these and soon was renowned as among the best of the best. Elfia Mulberry tells of the fateful day when the plot came to a climax. Despite his misgivings, Allo Craxes procured a room in a building overlooking the route that the black-hearted queen was to take that morning on the way to the flogging post, where the wretched victims of her displeasure were to be beaten that day. With spirit, Allo argued that he should be the one to bring down the tyrant, but his skills with the sling were palpably worse than that of Lena, and he left them, storming out to find strong drink, his customary solace. Along with her well-armoured retinue, the vile monarch rode her horse through streets that were empty, no commoner willing to risk her gaze falling on them and finding them insolent, insincere, or deficient in any way. Jansa's embraced Lena and wished her well, then handed her the sling. Lena tested the sling, and she weighed a smooth lead slingstone in her hand. With certainty in her heart that she could strike the monster dead, she strode to the window. Before she could let loose, however, the fiend stopped, and her bodyguards swarmed close, entirely enclosing her in large shields. The door to the room burst open, and troops overwhelmed Lena and Jansa's, though they fought with all their strength. They were taken to the dungeons beneath the barracks of the palace guard. There they died hideous deaths, alongside Allo Craxes, whose loose talk had betrayed Lena and Jansa's, much to his sorrow. Now, This was the inevitable fate of every conspiracy against Queen Grippina: betrayal, discovery, and death. It's not to say that her rule was unchallenged, but every challenge was dealt with quickly and ruthlessly. The war with Orenthia. While dealing ruthlessly with internal affairs, external affairs vexed Queen Grippina. Her haughty and disdainful manner was well and good in her own land, where she had absolute power, but outsiders were less impressed. Instead of delegating trade negotiations to trusted negotiators and administrators — she trusted no one after all — she insisted on conducting trade negotiations herself. The result was that Anarquist's precarious finances floundered even more, with trading partners unhappy with taxation and tariff arrangements unilaterally declared by Queen Grippina. When this unhappiness grew and complaints were made and non-compliance rife, Grippina, confident in Anarquist's central role in trade throughout the continent, ordered mass confiscation of goods and the execution of a number of foreign merchants residing in Anarquist in an extreme case of making an example of someone. This sort of high-handed dealing continued until, in 359, the major trading state of Orenthia declared war on Anarquist. In season 2 of this podcast, I recounted a number of minor conflicts between Anarquist and Orenthia. Despite the fact that they were major trading partners and this arrangement brought great prosperity to both realms, friction between them was almost a constant in their relationship. The difference in their systems of government was perhaps at the root of this, with the classical monarchy in Anarquist and Orenthia being a proud oligarchy, with some pretension of being a modern state. After a number of skirmishes, Grippina herself led the Anarquist army in the Battle of Torbrek Hill in 360. This battle is not one of Anarquist's finest moments, but in Orenthia, until its demise and disappearance as an independent realm, every spring equinox, the Battle of Torbrek Hill was celebrated as Orenthia's finest military victory. The Anarquist army numbered something close to 30,000. The Orenthians, only 10,000. But thanks to the Orenthians having an excellent position and making the Anarquistians fight uphill, and the rainy weather making the hillside boggy and hampering the overly confident Anarquistians as they slogged toward the well-set Orenthians, and then the skill and endurance of the Orenthian slingers with their well-formed lead sling bullets sending a rain of deadly shot down upon the Anarquistians, the day became a slaughter. Much to her displeasure, Grippina was forced to sue for peace, after which she had all the army commanders executed. Trade resumed, and uneasy prosperity settled on Anarquist. The succession. In the last year of her life, Grippina finally made it clear who would be the next monarch of Anarquist. She summoned her children, who by this time had grown to adulthood, and most of them had left the border fort to take various commands across the continent, much as their maternal grandfather had. Grippina chose Zalman to be her successor, but in a move unprecedented, she produced a document that's unique in Anarquistian history. She not only designated Zalman as her successor, but then she mandated that Yefin would follow him, then Enna would follow him, with Keska taking the crown after Enna. This, of course, was inconsistent with Varfina's choice method of succession, instituted by Queen Varfina in 278, and followed by every monarch since, where they chose their successor, but never attempted to bind the succession after that. We'll see what happened to the subsequent succession in the next episode. Personal life. Queen Grippina married the commander of her bodyguard, Finn Clon, in 392, and not simply because he was afraid not to. He was a stern, methodical man, happy to carry out her most heinous orders. It had been no secret they'd been lovers for some time, and while they lived separately, they managed to have four children: Zalman, born in 322, Yefin, born in 323, Enna in 325, and Keska, being a latecomer, born in 334. After that, Finn Clon was soon pensioned off with a small estate in the south of Anniquist near the mouth of the Geffo River, on the other side to the port town of Mira. Elfia Mulberry says that he never saw Grappina again, and her account of Grappina's mothering needs to be taken with truckloads of salt. But she says that she was torn in her upbringing of them. Grappina wanted to perpetuate her line, and so needed a strong heir to follow her on the throne, which led her to raise her children strictly, with much time spent in learning all the arts of governing according to Grappina. They had little time for games, idleness, or softness, according to Elfia Mulberry, and beatings were frequent. As they grew older, however, Grappina became more and more concerned that her offspring wouldn't wait for her to die or to hand over the crown, that the ambition she cultivated and the ruthlessness she insisted upon would leave them rankled and frustrated at not being in charge. She began to see preemptive strikes in their eyes, and so when Enna reached the age of 15 in 350, she had the three oldest, Zalman, Yefin, and Enna, sent to a border fort in the far west of Anniquist with orders for the commander to keep them there and teach them the military life. This left the youngest, Keska, in the palace with the queen, where she stayed until Grappina died in 371. As for Grappina's personality, likes and dislikes, hobbies and such, well, the picture we have of her is coloured somewhat by the bloody way she came to the throne and the ruthless way she held on to it. Every source we have seems to be appalled by her, and the descriptions that survive can't really be said to be overflowing with nuance. She was bad, nasty and bad, seems to be the whole of it. If we dig more deeply, and that's what I'm here for, deep digging, we can surmise that she was an extremely good planner and administrator. She was also no fool. Coins issued during her reign show her to be somewhat stern of gaze, but still with the usual Anniquistian good looks. One apocryphal anecdote survives that recounts that she had trouble sleeping, especially later in her reign, and would roam the corridors and walkways of the palace at night, entirely clad in black, her countenance formidably frosty. Guards were warned not to challenge or engage with any long, cool woman in a black dress that they might encounter, not if they valued their own lives at all. Last words. Queen Grappina was a usurper, but if the measure of the success of a usurpation is that they hold on to the crown and pass it to their heir, well, she was a successful usurper. She was cruel, inordinately so, and sometimes to her detriment. Living in Anniquist during her reign was a fraught experience, and the land lost many of its most important and useful people as they fled her ruthlessness. And the rest of the continent was the winner here, gaining expertise, knowledge and skill, particularly in scale-related magic, fabrication and trade. Grappina died in 371 and wasn't mourned at all. Her death wasn't celebrated, however, as her son and successor Zalman was cast much in the same mould as his mother, and fear still stalked the land. In the annals, the official record of each monarch's reign, Grappina describes herself as firm but fair. That's all, firm but fair. It's the briefest entry in the entire annals. And that's it for episode 22 of the World Below the War in the Heavens podcast. Coming up next, King Zalman the Vicious. Until then, farewell, and may the heavens smile upon you. This has been The World Below the War in the Heavens, a podcast exploring the history, culture, and esoterica of the world below, a continent of magic and mystery with inhabitants who keep one eye on the sky at all times. I've been your host, Michael Pryor. If you'd like to find out more about me and my books, pop over to www.michaelpryor.com.au. Farewell.